It was a little over a month ago that Karen Reed was acquitted on a second-degree murder charge in a case that many in the nation and certainly around here were obsessed with. And joining us this morning on this show, for the first time, one of her attorneys, Alan Jackson. Alan, good morning.
Hey, Greg, how are you this morning?
Great to have you on. I know it's early out there in California. Appreciate you taking the time.
Pleasure.
I mean, I've been trying to get you on since the trial, but I mean, I know you had other things you had to do.
Well, you know, I need a little courting. You didn't court me, Greg. Come on.
Well, I tried. You took to Instagram over the weekend to say that you're not done yet, and the next chapter is coming. I know there are a lot of us who want to know what that means, Alan.
Well, I was just sort of generally referring to something I'm very excited about, which is I've agreed to join Karen and her very capable defense team in the civil action. So I'll be coming back to Boston. You haven't seen the last of me yet. And the really good news is I'm going to be bringing Elizabeth Little with me as well. Mm. So the band is not just staying together, getting back together, but we're intending on writing a few new chapters.
That legal team, you're the legal team that you have joined, has sent subpoenas to the Mass State Police and the Norfolk DA's office seeking information on witnesses who testified at the trial, on Michael Proctor, and on evidence from the federal investigation. We discussed the federal investigation a lot on this show. From your perspective, in your opinion, did that federal investigation end?
No. I've never heard of such a thing. I know what Mr. Brennan said. I know what the hired gun said in court about being contacted and there being a closure to the case. We weren't contacted. I was never contacted. I've never heard a word of that directly from the horse's mouth. And I've been doing this for a long time, and I can tell you it's not a thing. It's just not a... Greg, you just don't do that. As a prosecutor, especially a federal prosecutor, you don't look at the target, call the target and say, oh, yeah, we're done. We're done here. What if something new comes up tomorrow, next week or next month, and you're within the statute? You don't, quote unquote, close investigations. So that's something that I'd never heard of. And in my opinion, there's no such thing as a, quote unquote, closed investigation. They can say whatever they want. Over at the Norfolk DA's office, I'm sure that was a curated comment or a series of comments, but I'll leave it to the feds to do what the feds do best, and that is to investigate. And that's exactly what I think is continuing to happen. But that's just my opinion.
Speaking of the DA's office, should the taxpayers in this state be concerned with how much was spent on both of these trials?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, this is the DA's office serves at the pleasure of the public. He's an elected official, and he's got responsibility to the public for their confidence and to their pocketbooks. I have no idea how much they spent. I know how much we spent, and I can imagine they spent as much or more. I mean, there were millions and millions and millions of dollars of taxpayer money spent that was completely unnecessary. Because of a persecution, not a prosecution, because of some sort of a personal vendetta. After the first trial, everybody knew what had happened inside that jury room, inside that deliberation room. She was acquitted. I've talked about this, the fact that Karen and I and our team may be the only attorney-client relationship where we've actually acquitted someone of murder twice. In the same case with the same charges, they knew that they couldn't prove this case coming out of the first trial. They knew they couldn't prove the case going into the first trial, and that they pressed forward. And then, of course, following the debacle of the first trial and the joke that was the unrecorded verdict, they forged ahead again. And it was it turned from a professional objective prosecution of a case to a personal vendetta. And it cost the taxpayers millions and millions and millions of dollars. I mean, just their special prosecutor alone, his bill was north of $500,000, closing in on $600,000, just him, for a completely failed prosecution.
Which is odd. You worked in the DA's office in Los Angeles as an ADA.
Yeah.
You have perfectly capable ADAs who could have tried this case, and it wouldn't cost you $600,000, correct? That's normally the way it goes.
Yeah, of course. Right? Yeah, that's normally the way it goes. And if Michael Morrissey didn't have those kinds of prosecutors who could try the case capably, then maybe he needs to find another job. That's his only job, is to populate the courtrooms with people who are competent, not just competent, but ethical. I don't know, maybe there were some ethical prosecutors inside that office who said, not just, I can't. They probably could have prosecuted the case. It's just a matter of calling witnesses and doing an opening and closing statement, putting on some evidence. I think he had prosecutors who said they wouldn't, because it's unethical. They didn't believe in it. So what does he do? He goes outside the parameters of the contours of his office and finds some defense attorney to come on board and switch hats midstream and become a prosecutor. It's outrageous.
Alan,
you just don't see this kind of thing.
Alan, I was so impressed with how you and your team were able to handle the first trial and the second trial, but it did feel so drastically different, the way in which you decided to handle witnesses. And the first trial seemed like there was just bombshell after bombshell. It was much more McAlbert's heavy, while the second trial was much more database. What went into the decision to kind of switch things up and choose to go down that road the second time around?
There wasn't a marked difference in what our theme and theory of the case was. As a matter of fact, there was no difference in what our theme and theory of the case was, which is the SUV never hit John. He wasn't killed by being hit by a car. That's the basic postulate. In the second trial, it was very clear that the prosecution was going to do something different. They were going to try to style themselves as a data-driven prosecution. We knew that the data helped us. So any trial lawyer has to do this. You have to be committed to your cause, but you also have to be able to be up on the balls of your feet. You have to be able to be nimble and pivot with the prosecution, because you're not just parrying, you're defending, but you're also, to a certain degree, you're on the offense as well. So what we decided to do was shift and learn from the first trial that I wanted to press much, much, much harder on reasonable doubt. And undermining everything they say about the data, because the data actually served our purposes. The data proved that the car did not hit. It did not collide with John O'Keefe. And so that's what you saw in the second trial, is a much more sort of tactical approach. They didn't call certain witnesses. They didn't call Brian Higgins. They didn't call Brian Albert. They didn't. There were big witnesses that they just forewent altogether. We knew that there was a chance they would do that. We didn't know until they closed their case who they were and weren't going to call. They didn't have to tell us in advance what their trial strategy was. But we were ready and able to sort of pivot on the move to not just defend against what they were presenting data-wise, but to attack them for not calling people like, oh, I don't know, how about Michael Proctor, the lead investigator on whose shoulders you base the entire prosecution, and you don't call him. So we knew that there was going to be some shifts, and part of being a good trial lawyer is to be able to make those shifts sort of on the fly, and that's what we did. And we did it with Karen's approval and with the rest of the team's approval.
Speaking of Michael Proctor, he has had a civil service hearing yesterday trying to get his job back, saying that suggestion is that he was not treated like other troopers. Does he deserve to be a trooper in Massachusetts?
Oh, my God. No, please tell me. Please tell me they're not going to give him his job back. He's claiming he wasn't treated like other troopers. Well, then act like other troopers. Don't do what you did, which is to take your trooper's hat off and to become a sort of a sideshow. This guy had so many biases going into the case. I mean, it was embarrassing. I don't need to go into, and I won't go into all the details of what he did, not just to the investigation, but to Karen Reed personally, just dehumanizing her, maintaining relationships with the people that he should have been investigating, the very people he should have been investigating. No. Look, to be a sworn officer and to take on the mantle of the protection of the community. That is a privilege, Greg and Courtney. That's a privilege. That is not a right. And he squandered that privilege with bias and a lack of objectivity and lying through his teeth about his own relationships, about dehumanizing with conduct that was dehumanizing of the person he was supposed to objectively be investigating. No, he's lost all his right to carry a badge and a gun. He's an embarrassment. He should never, ever, ever be in a position to control the community members that he serves. And that's exactly what being a police officer allows you to do. It's a lot of power, and he's not someone who should ever be commissioned with that power ever again.
Alan, you discussed objectivity. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you miss Judge Bev?
Oh, my God. That's a whopper. If I go the rest of my life and never have to walk into a room with Judge Bev, God bless her, it'll be too soon. And by the way, that's the other thing is, I don't have to say it. I was right there in the mix. I was in the fishbowl. I was wondering if others were clocking what I was seeing. You know, sometimes you're so far in it, it's like a fish that doesn't know it's wet. I wasn't sure if others were seeing what I was seeing inside that courtroom, but you know, a judge's job is to absolutely be unbiased, to put all of the biases aside. You know, everybody comes into life in any situation with certain biases. The job of a judge is to put those biases aside. And she showed very, very quickly and undeniably that she could not and would not do that. There were rampant biases in favor of the prosecution, in favor of the Commonwealth, in favor of Mr. Lally and Ms. McLaughlin, in favor of Mr. Brennan, once he took over, and against the defense from nearly day one, nearly from the moment I walked into court the first time on September 25th, 2022. There was a breakdown of the entire system, and she was part of it.
Do you believe that there was a conspiracy to frame Karen Reed? Or we debated this a lot on this show with Curtis. Or do you think it was just, you know, awful investigative work?
It's a combination of both, for sure, in my opinion. A combination of both. There was an awful investigative work, but it wasn't just incompetence. It went beyond just incompetence. You could read in Michael Proctor's text messages that it wasn't just incompetence. He had a view of her. He had a thought process about her from nearly day one, right? 16 hours into the investigation, he was already determining that he was going to make sure that it was going to get pinned on the girl. She's going to pay for this. Right? He said it out loud. He said the quiet part out loud. So it's not just incompetence. So now once you go beyond outside the parameters of just incompetence and being stupid, which there was a lot of idiots involved in the investigation as well. Once you go beyond those parameters, now you start getting into the very troubling area of a cover-up. Well, we know that tragically, an officer has lost his life. And we also know that we're going to pin it on this girl. So what does that mean by definition, Greg? What does that mean by definition? It means that you're going to cover up what actually did happen. You're going to actively cover up who is responsible. And lo and behold, isn't it amazing that the person that's supposed to be investigating is connected to and related to and with personal relationships to the very people that should have been number one, number two, number three on the suspect list. So you tell me, was Karen Reed framed?
Alan, since the second trial, there have been videos, photos making their way around social media of inside 34 Fairview. It seems like the new owners let you guys inside, whether you were down in the basement looking at the flooring that was pulled up inside the garage.
Right.
There was a video of you outside yelling, and from the Albert's bedroom, you could hear yourself pretty clearly. Will there be any type of... I know that you guys have signed on for different media rights. Will there be any type of way to dive deeper into that? Will that come up in anything?
Well, the pain point that the plaintiffs are going to have in their civil suit is this is a very different lawsuit. It's not a criminal lawsuit, and it's certainly not being governed by Judge Beverly Cannoni, who kept out so much of that information. That's why you're seeing it on social media rather than having seen it in the courtroom. All of it was relevant. We attempted to get most of it in, and we were denied, both in the first trial and the second trial. So this new lawsuit is probably a very good platform, I'd say, I would suggest to you, for a lot of that information to be aired out and aired out completely. So, yeah, I don't. That's not the last you're going to see of that information.
Just
that and a lot of other information.
To be clear, when you said this new lawsuit is, so you're joining her civil defense team to defend against the wrongful death suit. Are you also,
correct,
is Karen also planning a federal lawsuit on this case?
So that's a interesting question, not one that I'm willing to talk about right now. We have a
you're
lawsuit.
Under,
that's
can I remind you? Can I remind you? You're under oath,
counselor. I object, and I move to strike that comment from the record immediately.
By the way, also I offered countless legal strategies during the trial to Alan. Didn't use a single one of them. I just want to make that clear right now.
I think Alan needs your help.
Yeah. I've seen carnival psychics with a better track record than Greg when it comes to legal prowess. I'm just suggesting maybe not.
Alan,
we'll see what this new lawsuit entails. I can tell you this. I can say this. Karen has proved herself to be a fighter. She's not going to sit back in a corner and get punched, right? Everybody has a plan. I would suggest the following. Everybody has a plan, as the old saying goes, that Mike Tyson made famous, until they get hit in the mouth. And Karen Reed has shown that she knows how to hit others in the mouth, meaning how to fight back. I doubt seriously she's going to be a wallflower during the course of this new litigation. So whatever that means, we'll see.
Okay.
Alan, I know you're probably got something else to do this morning than talk to us. I just am so curious about the period between the trials. As someone who's, I don't understand, I've never studied law, is there any prerequisite or is there any onus on the Norfolk County DA to prove either new information, or how did you go from the ending and the conclusion of the mistrial into the beginning of the next trial? What was that process like, and what did the state have to do?
That's a great question. The state has an obligation, an ongoing obligation, to ensure that they do not ever present a case in front of a jury that they do not believe can be proved beyond any and all reasonable doubt to a jury of 12 objective community members. All right, that's the postulate, right? That's the baseline. They have an ongoing obligation to establish. That's the ethics of a prosecutor. You cannot just prosecute a case because it sits on your desk. You have to be convinced as a prosecutor, as an ethical prosecutor, that you can prove the case, prove all the elements of all the charges beyond any and all reasonable doubt to a jury, an independent jury. So after the first trial, it was our thought, there's no way that these folks are going to come back to the drawing board and say, oh yeah, we're going to do this again. It was nearly 4 months the first time, 3 months and a few days the first time. It ended with, you know, very famously now, it ended with acquittals that were not recorded. Of course the DA's office is going to go back, sit down at their desk, take a deep breath and realize, hey, you know what, guys and gals, we did the best we could. We put this case forward the first time, didn't work out. It's not going to work out any better. We don't have any new and different evidence. It's going to be the exact same thing the second time. It's going to cost the taxpayer millions, our taxpayers, millions and millions of dollars. We're going to take the loss and walk away. It's the just thing to do. That's the conversation they never had. What Michael Morrissey conversely did is he goes back to the drawing board and says, who can I hire outside the office who's willing to take this piece of garbage lawsuit and prosecute it? Oh, nobody in the office? I'll just go pay someone. It's offensive. It's offensive. I'm just going to go write someone a big enough check, basically bribe someone to come on board with a big check and prosecute the case that nobody else in the office can or will do. So what happened between the first and second trial is offensive. It never should have happened. And it was a complete abrogation of their obligations. And it's in keeping with Michael Morrissey's entire tenure as the DA. It's a fiefdom. He runs that like a lord in his manor. He doesn't run it like a public official. He's a disgrace. He's an absolute disgrace.
How deep do you think if you consider this to be corruption, how deep do you think it goes here in Massachusetts?
To its core. And that, when I say that, I don't mean that every single Massachusetts state police officer is corrupt. Not by a long shot. Most of them are hardworking men and women who get up every day and do the job that would strike fear in the rest of us, right? They run toward the danger. They run toward the bullets and the fire and the fights and those things. I have the deepest admiration for the lion's share of the men and women who do that job. I also have a deep admiration for the lion's share of the prosecutors who populate courtrooms around Massachusetts. But what I've seen during my time in Massachusetts, it hasn't been all that long, you know, a few years, going on 4 years now of working in Massachusetts pretty regularly. It's not a couple of cops. It's not just a couple of cops. What are the odds that you would get a Proctor and a Buchanick and a Tully and these folks that have all been disciplined, Kevin Albert, who have been disciplined, some of them been fired, almost all of them have been removed from their positions in one case. What are the odds? The odds are almost zero, unless the corruption goes extremely deep, unless that kind of conduct is rife throughout the community of the Massachusetts State Police. And also, it doesn't just go deep, it goes high. Michael Morrissey is at the top of that list. He knows better. He damn well knows better. He's a political hack who knows better. And all he cares about is his next election. That's all he gives a crap about, which is offensive.
Were you surprised to see Commissioner Cox say that he had no idea that Kelly Deaver was even involved in the Karen Reed case?
Who would be on that, Greg? He actually said, "I've never said the name Karen Reed. That name has never crossed my lips. I've never talked about her or talked about this case." Are you kidding? Are you kidding me? One of your officers was fallen. One of your cops was found dead on a lawn of one of your cops. And one of your, the third leg of that stool is one of your cops is central to the case, dealing with not just one of your officers who's dead, but on the central piece of that puzzle is it happened on one of your officers' lawns. And you're telling me you've never said the name, you don't know the name Karen Reed, you've never heard of this case, you don't know anything about it? Well, either you're incompetent or you're lying, one of the two. And now that you're saying that conversation with Kelly Deaver, however she wants to pronounce it, never took place, are you kidding me? Then that tells you one of two things is true. Either you're lying, Commissioner Cox, or you've just proved my point that she's a liar. Which one is it?
Well, Alan, you did have a good officer on the stand, though, for you guys, and Officer Barros. And in my opinion, watching that unfold, I think he's the reason, one of the main reasons that the jury swayed in your direction. I mean, he seemed like he was almost a smoking gun.
Nick Barros is a hero, no question. Like I said, most of the men and women carrying a badge and carrying a gun do God's work every single day, and he's among those. He is an absolute hero. He was willing to step up. There was no thin blue line. That's not the cloth from which he's cut. He doesn't care about those kinds of things. He's going to tell the truth because that's what he does. It's what he saw. It's what he heard. Whatever that is, that's what he's going to testify about. And that's what he did. He had the guts to get up on the witness stand and tell the jurors exactly what he saw. And what he saw was, and what he established was, that taillight was not broken, not completely smashed out when Michael Proctor first got a hold of that truck. It did not look like it did after he got a hold of it and after all those taillight pieces were found at 34 Fairview. That tells the jury all they need to know about the condition of the taillight and what Michael Proctor and his people were doing with that car.
Alan, who is in the running to play you in the movie?
I thought it was you. You and I talked about this, Greg. Well, you said it was you.
You know, I have done some acting.
You're going to have to go to Modern Pastry and just eat there for the whole civil trial for that to work.
He has an IMDb page, not a big deal.
I
I think there's an undeniable likeness. Come on.
You don't know.
I have no idea. Who knows? Who knows?
Right.
Danny DeVito, maybe? Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time, and it is of interest, I think, that you are now joining that team that will not only defend the civil case with Karen, but also decide whether or not there is a lawsuit to be filed. So, Wiggy, did you have one?
The only question I had for
Alan, Wiggy didn't watch much of the trial. I couldn't get him into it. I tried.
He wants Idris to play.
Exactly. Wiggy, I'll take my apologies now, Wiggy.
Believe me. Listen, the one thing I learned growing up as a kid, always know a defense lawyer. The thing I would just ask is, you know, in this situation, you talked about the money the state spent. Clearly, Karen Reed spent a ton of money. Where does she go to, I mean, it's probably impossible for her to get her life back, but where does she go to be able to recoup some of that money to pay you guys off?
Yeah.
Look, first of all, I don't care about the money. I've made it pretty clear in other forums that's not why I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. Every once in a while, you have this magnum opus case in front of you as a lawyer, and you better be willing to step up and do the right thing. Look yourself in the mirror and realize that at the end of your career, there have been times when people have needed you, people in need that can't do what they want to do and need to do without you, and you're just going to step up. So that's what we did.
You say that, Alan, you say that, and people lose their minds. Huh. They say, there's no way this guy's working for free. Think of all the attention that he's gotten out of this. Like, what's your answer to that when people say that?
My answer is that's exactly what's happened. I have not asked for a dime from her because it's cost her her life. Not just a bank account. It's not just, you know, she was not a rich woman to begin with. She was doing just fine. She was doing just fine. And she was, certainly better than a lot of folks financially. She was not a wealthy woman. It cost her everything. It cost her her life, her reputation, her job, her professorship, her entire bank account. She had to sell her house. She doesn't have a car. It cost her everything. So what am I going to do? Sit there and peel off more layers of that onion? If she were to get some sort of reprieve, some sort of financial reprieve, I couldn't live with myself. I could not live with myself. So every once in a while, it's just the right thing to do. So I don't know where she goes to sort of get her life back. She's going to try. She's going to work for it. She's not going to try. She's going to succeed. She will get her life back. She will. She's going to land on her feet. She already has. This first step in that process. But I'm not worried about Karen Reed. Karen Reed is as tough as nails. She's as tough as shoe leather, and she's not going to let this get her down. She will. There will be another very, very significant chapter to her life. What that looks like, only time will tell.
I'm gonna lock your number in.
Yeah. You may get a call. You may get a call from Wiggy Al.
Yeah,
I might know somebody. I might need you one day.
I like your pro bono.
That's what I'm talking about. Civil trial not live streamed, correct?
Doubtful. No, okay. there hasn't been a request, a media request that I'm aware of, and who knows what the judge would do in that case. But it's very, very unlikely. Very unlikely.
Alan, you're welcome on this show anytime, and look forward to catching up when you get back here in Boston, which became your second.
You guys are great. Yeah, keep a bowl of chowder warm for me. I'm coming back.
All right, Alan Jackson, thank you for taking the time, and we will be right back.